Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, Grand Avenue east and westbound is closed at Greenway Road because of an accident. There's also a collision near the 60 eastbound in the East Valley at Dobson Road. Valley weather for the rest of today, it'll stay sunny and hot, looking for a high temperature of 101. Sunny and even hotter tomorrow. We expect to top out at 104. Currently, relative humidity is at 9%, mostly sunny skies, and 96 degrees at KJZZ.
Next Tuesday's special election will go on as planned after Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich declined to postpone it. KJZZ's Will Stone has been covering this, and he joins me. So, Will, what did Brnovich have to say today?
Brnovich said that the Secretary of State, Michelle Reagan, did indeed violate state law, which requires that these ballot pamphlets are called publicity pamphlets. They have details about elections and what people will be voting on.
And pro and con arguments, things like that.
Exactly. They are, under state law, required to be sent out 10 days before voting begins. Early voting began last month. There was a glitch with the printing company, and it came out at the end of last week that about 200,000 households did not receive their publicity pamphlets. That could have affected upwards of 400,000 voters, possibly. And because of that, a local attorney came forward and asked for the special election to be delayed.
So Brnovich was clearly not happy about this situation, but he also said that he really was kind of powerless to stop it, right?
Yes. Brnovich said, you know, part of the issue is we're so close to the special election right now. Many people have already cast their ballots, and that the statute doesn't provide a suitable remedy at this point for fixing this problem. He doesn't believe that delaying the election is a good idea because that would disenfranchise these early voters. But he came down very strongly against Secretary of State Michelle Reagan, calling this a fiasco and other issues. So let's have a listen to that.
She's put all of Arizonans, including the people that are supportive of Prop 123, in a very precarious and a very bad situation. I don't know what the right word is to express it, but it pisses me off as an Arizonan and as the Attorney General.
And Will, Brnovich is also going to be looking into what happened here, right?
Yep. Brnovich said that this does not end today. While he doesn't plan to delay the election, he's going to launch an inquiry into when Reagan knew about this. And then a bigger question being, why didn't they alert the public? What we know is that on April 22nd, the Secretary of State's office said they first learned of the issue and they moved to correct it as quickly as possible. But there are definitely some outstanding questions about why at the time they didn't tell the public, you may have not got these pamphlets, you should go online or somewhere else to get this information.
And of course, Tuesday's election involves two ballot measures, Proposition 123, which proposes settling an education inflation funding lawsuit, Proposition 124, public safety, a pension reform. Those are two pretty big issues.
Yes. Governor Doug Ducey has been pushing Proposition 123 as essentially his fix to the inflation funding lawsuit. This isn't what anybody who wants that to pass would like to have going on right now. And it was definitely thrown a kink into this whole process.
KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Plans for the South Mountain Freeway had been in development for years, and the Arizona Department of Transportation and Federal Highway Administration are ready to move ahead with construction. But a federal lawsuit could cause further delays. And on Wednesday, federal judge Diane Humitiwa heard arguments in the case. KJZZ reporter Matthew Casey covered the hearing and joins me now. Matt, who are these plaintiffs, and why are they saying the South Mountain Freeway plan should be scrapped?
One of the plaintiffs is a group called Protecting Arizona Resources and Children, or PARC, and they were there yesterday. Another one of the plaintiffs is the Gila River Indian Community, and they were also there yesterday. And essentially, their case is an attempt to audit the process that state and federal agencies went through in planning the freeway.
Matt, it seemed there was quite a bit of emphasis on an environmental focus. How did that come into play yesterday?
The focus was on the National Environmental Protection Act and whether or not the state and federal agencies followed that. Vicki Glover, who's a member of PARC, says she's worried about what the South Mountain Freeway will do to the orange-tailed or carrot-tailed chuckwalla. She says ADOT commissioned a study on the freeway's impact on the lizard. AZ Game and Fish told them more research needed to be done. But
ADOT did not do that study. They're getting ready to blow up South Mountain and force the chuckwalla into extinction.
So, Matt, for the Gila River Indian community, there was an impact on three wells that they talked a lot about in their argument. Can you tell us about those wells and how significant those are?
The wells came up yesterday. There's three of them. The attorney for the Gila River Indian community says that planners with the state and federal agencies always assume that they'd be allowed to build on top of the wells, that the community would eventually sell them. Well, that's not going to happen. So attorneys for the defense say that contractors have been told to design the freeway around the wells. They're not sure if that, they won't know for certain if that will work until the design is finished. Gila River Indian Community Governor Stephen Rowe Lewis says the project is misguided and a waste of government money.
The air quality, the environmental impact, and the overall cultural impact to our community was never studied by both the federal and state agencies moving forward.
There are hopes on one side to start construction this summer. What did ADOT officially have to say in response?
Well, they say that they've done more work to understand the potential environmental impact that will be caused by the South Mountain Freeway than on any other previous highway project. They also said that there will be cost if it's delayed again.
It'll actually be reducing air pollution regionally throughout Maricopa County because a moving vehicle is always better than a stopped vehicle that pollutes.
So, Matt, at this point, what is next?
Well, Steve, that's unclear. Right now, we're waiting for the judge to issue a ruling. She said that she would take it under advisement and did not really give a lot of clues about which way she is leaning.
KJZZ West Valley reporter Matthew Casey with the latest on the South Mountain Freeway. Matt, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
We hear a lot about historic preservation in Phoenix right now when it comes to historic skyscrapers and mansions, but not so often when it comes to dilapidated affordable housing projects. But now, 38 acres of public housing in South Phoenix called Cofelt-Lamoureux that were facing demolition are being saved and renovated thanks to a first-of-its-kind deal between the county, the federal government, and a private developer. The show's Lauren Gilger went out to the development to find out more. And Lauren, tell us a little bit about Cofelt.
Well, it's like a small city in South Phoenix near 19th Avenue and Buckeye Road. It was built in 1954 as low-income housing. It has 301 units, and when it's full, almost 800 people live there. Brian Swanton showed me around Cofelt. He's the Arizona Market President for Gorman & Company, who's in charge of the renovation of the property, and he told me it's been deteriorating for years.
It's really showing its age. The buildings are pretty solid, but they have old swamp coolers that are really inefficient. They use a lot of water. We have streets with potholes so large you could lose a small car in some of them.
So a few years ago, the county thought the only real option was to demolish it. But there are about 300 people living there. So instead, the Maricopa County Housing Authority sold the project into a public-private housing partnership with Gorman & Company. They got the site listed on the National Registry of Historic Places, and they've come up with $44 million to renovate it. And they did it with the help of a U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development pilot program that's designed to save projects like this all across the country.
So, Lauren, what made the county change its tune from demolition to renovation?
Well, Swan says they did a health impact assessment with the people who were living there, and it became very clear that they didn't want to leave.
Who are we to tell 300 households that, no, you have to move someplace else in the valley? So we felt it was our responsibility to try and preserve this property on behalf of the residents who wanted to stay.
So do they hope this redevelopment model will be repeated for other old public housing projects?
Right. Well, this is definitely a part of a larger problem here in Arizona and across the country. Swanton said they were hired by the county in 2012 to look at their entire portfolio of public housing, about 1,000 units altogether.
The housing stock is very old, antiquated, obsolete. And the federal government does not provide the county adequate resources to maintain the housing up to modern standards. So HUD created this pilot program in order to find ways to sort of press the reset button on some of these old aging public housing developments across the state.
And this is sort of a national problem right now, right?
That's exactly right. They estimate that across the country, there's $225 billion in past due capital needs on the portfolio of public housing. And we need to find modern solutions to that problem, or else they're going to simply crumble and be lost to the affordable housing stock altogether.
Were you up against, let's just raise this and clear the land?
Yes, in fact, this project was originally on the list for demolition and disposition, meaning that the county was planning on knocking the whole property down. And the problem was we didn't have adequate places to move all 300 residents. And quite frankly, the residents wanted to stay. They really like living here. They didn't like the condition of the property, but they didn't want to move either.
You probably have residents who have lived here for a long, long time.
Yeah, we have residents that are living here that moved in the 1980s, early 1980s, and a lot of them, and they've lived here for generations. And this is a unique property. These are all duplexes that have front porches and front yards, and they can socialize with their neighbors in a unique way that you can't do in a standard apartment project, in a modern apartment project. So we really wanted to preserve the sense of history that is co-felt in terms of how the property is even designed and laid out and how people socially interact.
So do you feel like when you do a project like this, you're sort of preserving a piece of our history here?
Absolutely. In fact, we took it upon ourselves to list this property on the National Register of Historic Places. And that actually brought a lot of significance to this project, but it also brought a lot of financial capital as well. So the mantra is that you don't have to move to live in a better neighborhood, and we've adopted that mantra. And we want to make this neighborhood a better place and make Cofelt a shining example of what redevelopment really can be.
That was the show's Lauren Gilger talking with Brian Swanton with Gorman & Company. They're working with Maricopa County to redevelop the historic Cofelt Lamoureux Public Housing Project in South Phoenix. It's the show on 91.5 KJZZ for Thursday, May 12th. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein.
What do we call the events that produced the astounding paparazzi parade and live shot scrum all over Capitol Hill today as Donald Trump met with skeptical GOP leaders, including Speaker of the House Paul Ryan? Was this the kiss the Trump ring moment for Ryan?
Or is this the groveling Donald show? Conservative pundit and Trump critic Bill Kristol was calling this capitulation to Trump as he spouted off on MSNBC today.
And I would say that the meetings today might help an independent candidate. Trump is now in bed with the Republican leadership in Washington. He's a good deal maker, and I think he's made a deal on his terms, but still now he's going to be, you know, he's the head of the Republican Party. They're all getting along great. What happened to that independent shake things up?
They are going for unity however they can manage to achieve it, or Trump will just dump the congressional Republicans and they will turn their backs on him. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Which is it, Todd? What are we seeing?
It's really interesting, John, how much Paul Ryan seems to be playing both sides of this very dilemma. On the one hand, he had a great, personable, warm meeting with Donald Trump. On the other hand, he knows that it can't look like unification is the end game, and like everything else they're doing is just trying to fit in to the preconceived unification because it won't work. So first, the encouraging part, here's Paul Ryan after the meeting telling all of us just how great it went.
The question is, what is that we need to do to unify the Republican Party and all strains of conservative wings in the party? We had a very good and encouraging, productive conversation on just how to do that. It was important that we discussed our differences that we have, but it was also important that we discussed the core principles that tie us all together.
Do those core principles tie them all together, or are those exactly the things that are dividing them?
Well, here's exactly the problem. Paul Ryan said they agree on the Constitution. They agree that Hillary Clinton can't be president. But they also acknowledge they have deep policy differences. Donald Trump has said that he doesn't want to touch Social Security. He's called for raising the minimum wage. There are a whole bunch of other issues where he and Paul Ryan and conservatives like Bill Kristol are never going to agree. And that raises the immediate question back to Paul Ryan. Is this unity for unity's sake? Are you going to have a couple of meetings and then come out and say you're unified and just sort of do the kabuki dance of unification, or is there anything that you can really do to truly get on the same page here?
I don't want us to have a fake unification process here. I want to make sure that we really truly understand each other and that we are committed to the conservative principles that make the Republican Party, that built this country.
But in the end, Ryan has to come to Trump. There's no way around it. I mean, I just feel as though the Republican Party can't afford to give up on all of these voters that will vote Republican in November. They're stuck with Trump.
not only are they stuck with Trump, they're stuck with the voters that they believe that Trump has brought to the fold. So on the positive sunny side, here's Paul Ryan telling us reporters today, Donald Trump has brought millions and millions of people into the fold. And we need to acknowledge that and expand the Republican coalition in a way that's going to be healthy. That's the sunny upside for Paul Ryan. The downside is what's fallen over the other side of the ship. All of the conservatives who think that this new version of Republicanism has sold them out completely. You played Bill Kristol there, and he's only one of many. The conservative opinion writer George Will is another person who said Donald Trump needs to lose in all 50 states, and then we set about the work of making Hillary Clinton a one-term president. So you see that as animals get on one side of the arc, others jump off the back, John.
Although if I was Trump, and I can only imagine him saying this, the world has passed you by, old George Will and Bill Kristol, you silly kind of, you know, grandmotherly talking, you know, it's over for you guys. Trump would just like laugh in their faces.
And what you're illustrating, John, is exactly the question that a lot of people are asking. Is this a fundamental realignment of the Republican Party, a generational, once-in-a-lifetime realignment of the Republican Party that's taking place? Or is there some way to stretch and bend and convolute to keep the Republican Party as we know it and still fit Donald Trump, Paul Ryan, George Will, Bill Kristol, and the rest of them onto the same boat?
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
How can cities contribute to their residents' health? A conference today in Phoenix is exploring that question and looking at the connection between community design and public health. Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett is one of the speakers at the event being put on by Arizona Forward. He once put his city on a diet to bring awareness to obesity and is credited with making Oklahoma City more walkable and bikeable.
In the beginning, I realized Oklahoma City had an obesity problem, and I really didn't know how to address it, but I figured the first step was to probably start a conversation. So I did an awareness campaign and put the city on a diet and challenged them to lose weight. And as that program was taking place and people were signing up and doing better and we were raising awareness on obesity, we realized with that new awareness, we had an opportunity to ask the citizens to vote to change the built environment. And so now looking back, you can see that we've gotten away from our car-centric culture and are trying to create a healthier lifestyle with a city built around people instead of cars.
Did you find that changing that built environment, changing the infrastructure, encouraged people to do more relative to their health than they were willing or able to do before?
Yeah, there's no doubt that building the sidewalks, and we've built hundreds of miles now, is getting people, you know, out and a little more active. You know, my brother's a good example. He lived out in the suburbs, and when he saw that we were starting construction on a sidewalk, he told me, he said, I thought to myself, well, you know, we don't need sidewalks. Nobody walks out here. Then he realized maybe nobody walked out there because there weren't any sidewalks. The built environment definitely has the ability to affect the culture of the community. And we were just way too auto-centric here.
In addition to building out the sidewalks, what are some of the other things that you were able to do there?
Well, we have completed our bicycle trail master plan funding, and so we're building that out. It'll give us over 100 miles of trails when we're completed. We're also building new gymnasiums for all of the inner city grade schools. We're building senior health and wellness centers, and we're starting to get more serious about biking as transit.
Was it a tough sell to get residents to sign on to pay for all this?
Well, it was part of a larger quality of life package, but I think it was actually the parts of the package that people appreciated most. We believe that the quality of life is an economic development part of the equation. And health is a significant part of economic development. I mean, if you're trying to create jobs, which we're always trying to do, you've got to realize that job creators are worried about healthcare costs, they're worried about absenteeism rate, and if your community has a reputation for having poor health, you're not going to be leading the way in creating jobs.
As you were going about trying to figure out what exactly you wanted to do in Oklahoma City, were there other cities that you looked at as models and said, hey, you know, this city has done this, maybe we could implement some form of that here?
Well, there were different cities that put in, you know, the bike lanes and certainly the trail system. But I don't know that anybody has rebuilt their entire downtown street system the way we have. We took a system that had basically five-lane roads, and most of them were one-way, and we've narrowed them, made them two-way, highly landscaped them, narrowed the streets to give the pedestrian a fighting chance against vehicular traffic. And so I don't think anyone has done a complete makeover of their downtown grid the way we have. But it's hard to go back into that built environment and make changes in an efficient manner. We're doing it, but it's a lot more costly to build sidewalks and things like that later. It's a lot better to do it when you're designing the road originally.
Mick Cornett is the mayor of Oklahoma City and one of the speakers at today's Stewardship Summit program on the connection between community design and public health. The event will also talk about those issues closer to home. Mesa Mayor John Giles is part of a statewide roundtable featuring mayors and city managers.
You know, the people that live in Mesa, I think this is not a phenomenon unique to Mesa, but countrywide, people are, I think, more interested in being active, and the types of recreational amenities that they're looking for in their community have changed. And so we've tried to adapt as a city and focus the city's resources and in ways that people want us to. So, for example, the parks that we're building now, we're building less golf courses and more trails and mountain bike parks, and creating more opportunities for people to walk and enjoy shade and be outdoors. And I think that's in response to what people are interested in doing now.
How much of what Mesa is doing is new construction, and how much of it is retrofitting infrastructure that's already there?
Certainly a lot of both. But for example, the last park that we dedicated was a mountain bike park, but it was a desert mountain, and so it required certainly some capital expense to come in and create a parking lot and some directional signs and some landscaping. But for the most part, it's a twofer that we were preserving a pristine desert area, and at the same time giving people an opportunity to recreate in a way that they want to nowadays. Mesa passed a big parks bond 3 years ago, a big $70 million. And part of that money is being spent in retrofitting existing parks to make them more what people are interested in. Right now, if you drive by Riverview Park on the west end of Mesa by the Cubs Stadium, I guarantee you there's never an hour of the day that I've ever driven by there whether the big climbing apparatus that's there is not covered with kids. So we're trying to recreate some of those amenities at some of our older parks. For example, Pioneer Park, the big anchor park that we have in our downtown area. We're about to put up a chain link fence around that park for a few months and recreate some of the really neat features that you see at this very popular park over by the Cubs Stadium.
You mentioned that these are amenities that people want, but I'm curious how much they want and use them in the middle of the summer when it's just incredibly hot outside.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have to be sensitive to that and realize what our environment is. So, for example, at the Pioneer Park that I just mentioned, the big ticket item in that park is going to be a splash pad. Also, that park is particularly attractive, I think, because we've got a lot of older shade trees there. Shade is an important element of everything that we do.
When you talk about trying to get people outside and walking and biking, I'm wondering if you find it more difficult to do that in the suburban parts of Mesa as opposed to the downtown core, where you have higher density and more people and more things to do within walking distance?
Well, we absolutely have tried to be sensitive to creating a pedestrian-friendly environment in the more urban parts of town, downtown in particular, but also out in, for example, the Fiesta District. We just redid the streetscape out there and did it in a very pedestrian-friendly way. So you're right, in an urban sprawl, city environment, we're still somewhat tied to our vehicles, but that's changing with the arrival of light rail into downtown and the fact that millennials and seniors and others are craving a more urban environment and are less anxious to be tied to their cars. They're looking for a more high-density situation to live in and to recreate in. We're seeing even more demand for these types of amenities.
Mesa Mayor John Giles. He was a participant in a roundtable discussion during today's summit on building healthy cities for healthier lives. It was put on by the group Arizona Forward.
So, Steve, have you ever looked at your family tree?
Yeah, Mark, every day. Great, 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 great people.
Okay, but have you actually, like, traced it back a ways?
You know, I've discovered that I've come from, I think, Hungarian and Irish royalty.
Oh, wow. Well, I come from a family from a Polish village that may or may not still exist.
Well, my family came over on the Mayflower.
Well, well, well. If it isn't our senior producer, Jimmy Jenkins. So, Jimmy, what you're saying is the Jenkinses have been here for a while?
Well, no, this is on my mother's side. They were called Finley, or it might have been Farquharson. Anyway, that was a couple hundred years ago. Imagine tracing your lineage back hundreds of thousands of years.
Wow, Jimmy, that just sounds tiring to me.
Well, don't worry about it, Steve, because researchers from around the world have done just that by taking a closer look at the Y chromosome. Melissa Wilson-Sayers is a professor at ASU, and she studies genetics.
The Y chromosome is only inherited through the genetic male lineage, and for most of the Y chromosome, it doesn't swap DNA. So it really is this unique marker of genetic paternal ancestry, and for the most part, it's excluded from a lot of genomic studies, partially because it's this tiny piece and partially because there's a lot of technical challenges to looking at the Y chromosome. And so with this study, we were cataloging the variants, so different DNA mutations of different types across the Y chromosome and then comparing them across people from across the world.
They looked at DNA samples from more than 1,200 men from around the world.
That's a lot of swabs.
Yeah, a lot of Q-tips. And they are able to find these patterns because so much of the Y chromosomes are similar to one another.
In this study, we report over 65,000 variations on the Y chromosome across those 1,244 people. And that sounds like a lot of variants. But we were looking across 10 million sites. And some of those are just single letter changes, so an A to a T or C or G across the different people. But the majority of the things that we found were those single letter changes. And one of the things that those single letter changes allow us to do are to track how the Y chromosomes are related to each other. And it lets us infer, at least for the Y chromosome, how the Y chromosomes have been spreading across the world. And in particular, which ones persisted.
So, Jimmy, were they able to see how humans have evolved and traveled?
Yeah, they found that there was a population explosion around 50 to 55,000 years ago across Asia and Europe, which is about the time when some scholars think modern humans were moving out of Africa. And there was another explosion in the Americas around 15,000 years ago.
So what causes these population explosions?
Well, at this point, it's all speculative, but scholars think things like access to new territories with vast amounts of resources, as well as things like wheeled transportation and advancements in metalworking probably played a big part. So all of this was discovered by studying differences in our DNA, but Sarah says this data actually reinforces a theme she comes across again and again in genomics.
Those differences are the things that are important for identifying clinical differences, so reasons why we might have different medical ailments or genetic disorders. But also, if we don't understand the underlying similarities, then we don't know what's different. So we were looking across 10 million sites. And so for most of those 10 million, let's say, right, I mean, well over 9 million sites were identical across all of the people that we were looking at. And so to me, that's really empowering to recognize that most of our DNA is really shared across all humans.
So wait, Jimmy, are you actually saying we're not all special snowflakes?
I think you're special, Mark.
Oh, thanks.
Well, I think you're both special.
Oh, KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Thank you, Jimmy.
You got it, guys.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name's David Crummy. We're here in front of the Mesa Art Center, right at the Center and Main Street Light Rail Station, checking out Musical Shadows. So you're walking down the street and you see these weird colored tiles and you sort of walked over it and it yells at you and you're like, what?
I was just kind of waiting for the bus and I was like running around on it and I realized it made noises. So I spent probably about half an hour just figuring out what noise each of them made.
And you have to stretch your arms and you bring multiple people together to make different sounds, and you can actually make music and melodies.
That's David Crummy and Shannon Fairbanks interacting with the Musical Shadows installation outside the Mesa Arts Center. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just wish our voices would stay in the shadows, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. Many people stay in a relationship or an occupation because it's part of a comfortable routine, or because we're generally taught to stick with something, commit to it, and persevere. In that context, perseverance is clearly seen as a positive. Meanwhile, the concept of surrender is typically a pejorative. Writer Brendan Tapley, though, spoke with people to learn more about the idea that perseverance and surrender are actually two sides of the same coin, and that applies to our personal and professional lives and the creative choices we make. In a few minutes, I'll talk to a woman who gave up being an opera singer as she worked on Perseverance versus Surrender. First, though, writer Brendan Tapley joins me. Brendan, what is more courageous, leaving a frustrating situation or proving we can get through it?
Sometimes people think of surrender as an apathy, you know, a kind of refusal to engage. But if you actually really commit to surrender as an idea, it's kind of the rope that allows us to lower ourselves into, you know, a confrontation with self, and to determine which motives, whether they're to persevere or surrender, are healthy, which motives aren't rooted in fear, which motives get us toward alignment. So the notion of heroism in war, I think you'd have to ask yourself maybe those three filters. Is this decision aligned with my values? Is it rooted in fear or not? And how much of it is internally derived versus societally derived? The way another analogy is to think about a marriage. If you're only staying in a marriage because there's an external approval for that, you're not really being driven by a love or commitment to that person. You're being driven by a love and commitment based on societal perception. That doesn't really feel like good perseverance, or working at a job that's strictly based on perceived prestige, or because you fear making a change for better. That feels rooted in fear and not really about persevering in the best sense.
Are there examples that come to mind for you about good perseverance versus bad, and good surrender versus bad?
A good example of bad perseverance was the financial crisis and how groupthink sort of took over, and the idea that people perpetuated very poor practices simply because that was the presiding group feeling on the matter, and the pressures therein. Another case, by contrast, bad surrender, you could consider what people call the bystander phenomenon, which is people who do not intervene when they see something happen, say on a street if someone's being harassed or that kind of thing.
How often do perseverance and surrender coincide with happiness, what we perceive as a goal of being happy?
I think it is tied to happiness, but I think sometimes that has a delusional quality to it, right? Because happiness can also be highly dysfunctional. Is it happiness that becomes the barometer of whether to persevere or surrender, or is it right alignment? You know, is it alignment with yourself? Is it fulfillment based on a larger vision of what you can be and what you can contribute? Sometimes those come with a lot of trials, but those trials can be joyfully endeavored if the larger result there is that you align with who you were meant to be in this lifetime. I mean, to me, that's not always happy, but it is, in the end, the most rewarding.
The idea that perseverance really is seen as good, and surrender, when people hear surrender, most people think of that as bad. At what point do we have expectations for ourselves to see through both the simplicities and complexities of our everyday lives?
I think people in general have to become more comfortable with ambivalent emotions and have the notion that it's okay for them not to know immediately what to do, and to have that grittiness. Even, and grittiness to know can be in surrender, that you, in taking that pause, you're saying, I'm really going to commit myself to understanding this. So if you've had an argument with your spouse, it may actually be the most virtuous thing in the world to go take a walk and reflect on what it is that person said, whether there's merit to it, how you might respond to it, what you can do if you need to change, rather than demand that that person sit right there and have a three-hour conversation with you about what they just inventoried. Because what may end up happening is that in that step back, something gets illuminated for you that ends up completely streamlining that moment and deepening your connection. It may also illuminate something for you that's non-negotiable, and that can be useful too.
Writer Brendan Tapley. Varunka Vakova was an opera singer from an early age. It was how friends and family thought of her and how she viewed herself. It was traumatic for her to give that up, but also helped her see that there was much more to the world. And Varunka joins me now. Varunka, did you ever envision a time of life when you wouldn't be an opera singer?
I used to practice 2 hours a day. I used to go to the library and I'd fill up my bags with opera scores, and they're very heavy. It was a big part of who I was for many, many years.
Well, so at what point did you start to feel like maybe it wasn't right for you anymore? Maybe you needed to start looking at something else? Was that a gradual process?
Well, I felt throughout it, there was every once in a while there was a moment, and I'd say, well, I don't really like this part of it, like the business part of it, or if I didn't really get along with some of the people in the field, I would kind of look past it. But then there was a point when, with any art form, basically, you're very passionate about it, but there's a lot of struggle in it. My deciding factor was when my struggle became a lot more than my passion for it, right? It was a lot larger. So the passion, after a while, it started to fade because I was struggling and I wasn't happy. And I tried it in America, and then I lived in Europe actually for a while. I thought, oh, if I move to Europe, maybe it'll feel a little bit better and maybe ignite it more, and it didn't do that. I think when you start off with something, you have hopes and dreams, and it's not exactly what you thought it was going to be at the end.
Obviously, your closest friends know you in a different way, but let's say acquaintances don't, and they think of you as the opera singer. How big an adjustment was that to go from the person identified that way to the person who is not? Were you ready for that change?
It was very painful. I would say the first year was the hardest, and then a year and a half, you start feeling better, and I think it takes about 2 years to kind of feel, okay, distance from it, because initially you say, okay, well, I don't have to practice 2 hours a day, and that's weird at first. Okay, I'm not going to practice 2 hours, or I'm not going to the library and making copies of that opera score or searching online. So it's little by little you start kind of not doing that as much, and that feels very strange. I think you feel lost for a long time, and I've spoken with other people. My friend, she's a cellist, and she stopped performing, and it was a hard transition for her, but now she's a lawyer. You know, she went to do something else, but it's hard because it's not only what you're dealing with in yourself. Wow, this is who I was defined. I was defined in this way for such a long time, and that's no longer who I am, but it's the people around you that are reacting, because some people will say, oh, well, either she didn't keep going, she should have kept going, why did she stop? Or I would have had people come up to me, no, but you're good. Why would you stop? But I wasn't happy. And for my friend that's the lawyer, she had people tell her, oh, well, you sold out. And that's another thing that you get in the arts.
When you decided to make the big change and not do opera anymore, do you feel like it was a courageous move inside, at least? Or did you in any way feel like you were giving up on something that you should keep doing?
Yeah, in a sense, you at the beginning, you think, am I a failure because I'm not continuing? Other people are going forward. Why am I not going forward? Or even I would talk to my mother and she'd say, oh, but you put so much time into it. And so you hear these things and you start panicking. And then eventually you find peace within yourself. I always felt like it's like a breakup. So you're dating this person and then you have this idea of who they are. And sometimes they don't end up being that person that you had in your mind. And you have to, in a sense, be at peace once you break up. Be at peace with who they actually were and know that they were there to teach you some sort of lesson, and then you can move forward from there.
Varunka Vakova, we've been talking about the concepts of perseverance and surrender.
Arizona has stepped up its participation in a national tool called BioSense. It helps health officials do surveillance on a variety of health conditions. Basically, when a patient visits an ER or is admitted to the hospital, the information from the hospital's medical record is automatically sent to the program, which helps officials in different states identify trends. The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention rolled it out several years ago, and Arizona started taking part 2 years ago. Jessica Rigler is chief for the Bureau of Epidemiology and Disease Control at the Arizona Department of Health Services. And Jessica, are more Arizona hospitals a part of this program now?
That's correct. Yeah, we're up to 26 hospitals now in the state that are reporting data into BioSense, and we're trying to get all the hospitals in the state on. It can be a slow process, and so we're moving through that with onboarding hospitals over the next several months.
What do hospitals have to do? Because a lot of them are kind of overwhelmed and overworked as it is. So is this sort of an added step that they have to do?
At the outset, this is an added step for hospitals to do. They need to make sure that their electronic medical record can talk to the BioSense system, so it takes some IT configuration, I would say. But after that, it's a seamless process and the data flows automatically.
So what kinds of things then do you look for when you have all this data, both from here in Arizona and throughout the region and across the country? What kinds of things can you try to find?
The BioSense system is very robust because all of this emergency department and inpatient data are coming in. And so we're really exploring the best ways that we can use this data. And we've got a couple of really great examples and things that we're working on right now. So one of those is if there's special events in our community, for example, the Super Bowl that happened last year, we can monitor the data that's in from hospitals around the area of the Super Bowl to determine if we're seeing any increases in people reporting to the emergency room for some kind of gastrointestinal illness or respiratory illness. And that might alert us that there's something abnormal going on in our communities that we need to take a look into.
And does the data come in quickly enough where you can look at it in basically real time like that?
That's the benefit of the system, is this is near real-time data. So the other kinds of disease data that we get can take between 24 hours and 5 days to be reported to us because it's based on a diagnosis or a laboratory test result. And so if we have a bunch of salmonella cases, for example, in the state, it might be a week or two before we identify that there's an outbreak. The BioSense data comes in real time, and so we're able to see almost within a day that there's some kind of abnormal health occurrence in our community so that public health can respond.
With summer coming up, obviously West Nile virus season is almost upon us. Is this the kind of system that might be helpful in terms of figuring out where mosquitoes are and where mosquitoes that might be infected with West Nile are and help influence where fogging efforts or other kinds of efforts might go?
That's a great question, yeah. So we are actually using the system to look at mosquito-borne diseases to determine if there is an increase in our communities in mosquito-borne disease. Again, people get tested for these diseases and we'll get those laboratory test results, but that takes a while. And so we have these syndromes set up in the system where we can look to see if there's an increase in people that are presenting to the emergency department with symptoms of West Nile virus or other mosquito-borne diseases. We'll be able to pick that up much more rapidly than laboratory testing, and then we can go out to those communities and conduct better mosquito surveillance or mosquito control or get out prevention messaging.
Have there been incidents where you have noticed something about hospital ER intakes and where you've been able to realize, hey, there's something going on here or something going on with this kind of illness, and you've been able to respond to it using the system?
At this time, we've not been able to detect anything with the system that's caused us to convene a public health response, which I think is a good thing. We haven't had any massive outbreaks or anything like that that the system has detected. But part of that also is that it takes a critical mass of hospitals reporting into the system before you can really start to identify those trends. And so we're finally getting up to that critical mass where we will be able to. We're really looking forward to this summertime, though, because another thing that we can use the system for is heat illness surveillance. And so we know when it's hot here in Arizona, especially in the valley, that people get sick from the heat. But what we don't know is exactly what temperature does that start. And so this system will give us a better indication if there are people coming into the emergency department with heat-related illness. Maybe even before we've put out heat advisories, we'll know more rapidly, and then communities can open up their cooling centers faster, get water and information out to people that may be out on the streets, and we can do a better job at helping protect our communities from heat.
Major League Baseball has been a part of Arizona for many decades as a host area for spring training, but it wasn't until 1998 when the state unveiled its true home team, the Arizona Diamondbacks.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the big leagues. Now we invite you to share the excitement of our first opening day.
Baseball historian John Darren Tenney explores the much deeper history of the game in Arizona way before it was played in an air-conditioned dome. Tenney's new book is called Baseball in Territorial Arizona, A History, 1863 to 1912. John, was baseball used for something other than leisure back then? Was it used to settle scores?
There was a lot of gambling going on. They gambled on everything. I mean, if there was any kind of a contest, whether it was cards, dice, it didn't matter. I mean, bare-knuckle prize fights. I mean, if you could bet on anything, a foot race, a horse race, it just kind of naturally fit into, you know, people would raise wagers, our team's better than yours.
Was there land that was set up to actually play baseball?
Baseball did not exactly look like that. The distances may or may not have been altered because military posts in the territory at that time were basically you had an open parade ground in the middle of the post, and that's where they played.
Are there good legends that you discovered that may or may not be stories that are stretched a little bit related to Arizona and even the conditions?
There are, especially when I started looking at all of the major league teams that were coming through here. You look at how the reporters from like the Boston Globe in 1911 when the Red Sox made a spring training stop in Yuma and how they described the baseball field in Yuma as just basically being akin to a sandbox littered with cactus, and the grandstands was covered with palm fronds and very extremely rustic.
Yeah. Did people go to watch these games? Were there spectators?
Of course.
Because there wasn't anything else to do or because they really loved it?
I honestly think it was the curiosity of the game first that drew people in, and then the excitement that, one, there was, of course, you know, money on the line, but two, you know, baseball, you know, is an exciting game to watch back then because the equipment was, until the glove wasn't really an integral part of the game until well after 1890. So you figure Arizona's had been playing baseball for almost two decades without using any kind of a glove.
And the bats look like bats would today?
They do. They're just thicker handles.
Mm-hmm. In the early 20th century, late 19th century, was there a transient population that affected maybe the popularity of the game or whatnot?
Yes, very much so, because Arizona was still built around mining, and you had people coming out here and, you know, staking mining claims for gold, silver, and copper. Sometimes it worked out. Oftentimes it didn't, and people were moving and moving out. So what I was starting to see through the newspapers is there's boom and bust cycles popularity of the game. Like, you'd have a couple of years where it just, in one community, it would just be all over. They'd play all the time. And then as the economy and everything started to reverse itself, the game went away because everybody was more, you know, of course, paying attention to running their businesses or, you know, making sure that their families were taken care of. And if it didn't work out, they moved on.
Were there expectations? Did you have things going into the research where you thought, I kind of expect this to have been the case, and there were things that flipped a 180 on you? Were there certain surprises?
There was a story that was written as a report that showed up in the Army-Navy Journal a few years after it happened. In 1872, there was a Christmas match at Fort Bowie, and in attendance was none other than Geronimo and some of his...
Wow.
Men. And I was like, wow. And so I went off on a kind of a mini tangent trying to find out, okay, I wonder what he thought, mm-hmm. witnessing this strange game with a bat and a ball and soldiers running around and all the noise and the commotion.
John Darrentenny, he's the author of Baseball in Territorial Arizona, A History, 1863 to 1912. Okay, Mark, you know how sometimes you see this beautiful scene in real life, and when you snap a photo, it just doesn't do it justice?
Ah, so frustrating.
One local artist who goes by Exandris feels the same way.
I was hiking one day, and I went just a little off the trail, and I saw this magical scene.
She was in the Superstition Mountains,
where everything was just in this pinkish, beautiful glow, and I just was in awe of the beauty of it.
Well, she's a painter, so guess what she did next?
I got a really big 4x8 board, you know, at Home Depot. Then over 2 weeks, I painted the entire landscape.
That's when the real work started. Over the next 4 months, she says she worked nonstop, painting a continuous line that snakes through the entire scene and blends in with most of the landscape.
Yeah, it kind of looks like one of those mazes from a kid's puzzle book. Lots of switchbacks and twists and turns, but it never crosses itself, and it covers that entire 4x8 board.
Exandra says the effect creates more depth to the image. It gives it volume.
It was all planned out so that the underpainting and the overpainting, which is the lines layer, would blend together when you're at a distance. They don't exactly merge, but they work together so that you see the scene that I saw that day when I was hiking.
She calls it waltzing in the superstitions, and this method took her hundreds of extra hours of work, but this is Exandris' style. She calls it her fingerprint. She says she's made at least 50 works of art this way.
I adore traditional painting as well, but this provides a special challenge for me because I love brain teasers and puzzles and things of that nature.
If you are also a lover of brain teasers, Xandrus is offering a prize to anyone who can find the two ends of this line.
But be warned, it's a little bit like trying to find the end of a rainbow. The painting is hanging up at Marshall Square in downtown Scottsdale, and a photo of the painting is also on our website at kjzz.org.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.